everyone, and that may attract people here, it may drive some away, I don't know. But we are waiting for our quorum today. We will be on teleconference with both Valdez and Anchorage, so we'll open up our meeting on committee substitute. Let me see, committee substitute for House Bill 167, Judiciary. It's an act relating to air quality control and the prevention, abatement, and control of air pollution relating to inspections and enforcement powers of the Department of Environmental Conservation and providing for an effective date, and it's sponsored by Representative Hanley. Before we get to House Bill 167, though, I do want to note that yesterday we passed from committee substitute for House Bill 179, Finance. That was the fee bill. I have a draft. If anyone wants to look at it, I reviewed it. It looks fine. I would like to move it on to the clerk, but if anyone has any objections before we do transmit it, here's a copy to look at. Hearing no objections, we will pass it on.
I can see it real well.
It's written with the 10% there, not the 35. So with that, let me check out the teleconference. Representative Parnell has now joined us, so we can start our meetings this morning. Can you hear me in Valdez and Anchorage?
Do we have a quorum? Five is quorum?
We need one more.
Jerry, just fine. In Anchorage, Valdez has not joined the conferences yet.
Okay, how many do we have in Anchorage that wishes to be heard?
We just have one observer here.
Just have one observer. Okay, we're still waiting for a quorum. We have five at this time. We need six. And then we're formally going to start the meeting, so we'll have you hang on line here then this morning.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I've got it all filled out in the envelope. I just have to take it over there. It's right down the street here.
Well, we got six and a half here. No.
Six and two-thirds.
Six and two-thirds today. Not quite two votes. Okay, we do have our quorum. We're able to conduct business. The bill before us is sponsored by Representative Hanley. So at this time then, I'd like to ask Representative Hanley to give us a brief review. It weighs enough, therefore it must be a good bill. Right?
Got it right. Eight more pages of footnotes behind it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think just to give everybody an idea, I'll just go briefly over a little bit of the history. And then the department, Mr. Tom Chappell is here, who has been intimately involved in this for a number of years. And we'll give an overview. He's the expert on the whole thing. And then whoever wants to testify too. I hope we can get through anybody that has public testimony as well. So I'll keep my comments short to start, and then we'll let Mr. Chappell. Basically, the Clean Air Act passed, I think, in 1990 and required states, actually didn't require states, but they adopted a whole bunch of new requirements for states on their air programs. We have a deadline of December of this year or November of this year. Tom knows, but basically we have to pass a piece of legislation this session so that they can begin adopting the regulations, or there's penalties involved. Essentially, we can take over the air quality program. If we don't, EPA will come in and take over the program, as well as they have some mandatory withholding requirements of federal funds, so that if the federal government takes over the program, we stand to lose 100% of our federal highway funds. And Tom can speak to it, but I think people in general feel that having DEC run the program in this state is a lot better. They've shown that their fiscal note for running the program is significantly less than what the federal government has indicated it would cost to run the program if they came up here and did it. Also, the money, there is a dedicated fund situation where the fees, the department or whoever runs the program is required to charge fees of the industry that's being regulated to pay the total cost of the program. That's a federal requirement, and there's also a dedicated fund that's required, and we will have a dedicated fund, but the legislature under the, if the state takes over the program, does have the ability to appropriate from that fund and have some oversight, at least over the size of the department and the kinds of things that are going on. Last year, Representative Tom Moyer out of Fairbanks introduced the bill. It was also very large. It started a working group, I guess you could say, within a subcommittee that he had, developed a lot of compromise language between those that are going to be regulated, the department and others, and the bill almost made it to the floor in the House anyway last year, but didn't quite make it. In the interim, the department started their own working group with, I think there's a list of the people in the packet, largely it had some department people, some a private citizen, one representative of the environmental community, and a number of members from the industry that would be regulated on there. They worked on in fact, they were still working up until a couple of weeks ago on language and trying to come up with a program. At the beginning of session, Representative Brown introduced a bill that was based on one of the working drafts. Well, actually, her first draft was on one working draft of the working group's bill. Senator Miller on the Senate side introduced a bill based on a similar draft a little bit later. Their language is different. I've introduced a bill that actually went beyond what the working group had originally proposed. I pretty much went back and took a lot of the language that was adopted last year in some of the issues that either the working group didn't address at all or didn't get to or address briefly to try and bring those to the attention and at least have them debated. Since the beginning of session, the working group has looked at a number of the sections. There was a legislative working group, I guess you'd say. Senator Miller had a subcommittee that worked with the three bills trying to consolidate those sections that were exactly the same, get the language the same where the intent was the same because the drafting was a little bit different on a number of them, and then also addressed a number of the other sections. And the working group has looked at those, some of those anyway, and agreed with some, and Mr. Chappell can speak to that. That's a little bit of the history of the of where we are, I guess with that, I'd turn it over to Mr. Chappell to give us a brief overview of the, or unless you want to go to public testimony, but Tom is going to have a few minutes to give us an overview of exactly what's here, okay. And then we can go through. I might just mention, too, that there are, I think it's come down to, there's like four or five sections in the bill out of 40 pages that are controversial, I guess you'd say. There's major differences of opinion on some of these. They're largely policy calls. And that was the intent of everything, is to try and get the bill into a form where we could focus on the five or six, or some people may just, there may be seven sections or small parts, but generally to focus on those areas that are controversial, and largely they're policy calls. And I think that's where we are with the bill, that based on the working group and last year's language and everything that's floating around, hopefully that's where we'll focus, and I can go into some of those areas as soon as we get into it a little bit more, what the controversial areas are.
Okay, what we'll hear then is from Mr. Tom Chappell for the overview, and, well, Mr. Chappell's coming up. I'd like to double-check to see if Valdez is online yet. Is Valdez online?
Yes, we are, and that's just a participant list.
I'm sorry, did you say you have one participant?
We have two to testify, and I did just send the list down.
Okay, thank you. After Mr. Chappell's overview, then we'll start our public hearing. And do we have anyone in Anchorage yet who wishes to testify? Okay, we'll.
Yes, there is somebody in Anchorage that would like to testify.
Okay, we will hear then from Mr. Chappell, then we'll move to Valdez, and then we'll move to Anchorage for the testimony. Mr. Chappell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Chappell. I'm the project manager of the permitting group within the department for the air program. And what I'd like to do, if it pleases the committee, is talk about a few of the major components that this bill is trying to address in the Clean Air Act. I believe in the packet that was handed out, there is a set of overviews that kind of are based on graphics of what I would like to address, and there's three or four of the first part of this I'd like to go over. The second page of that, which shows a figure focusing on the Clean Air Act, tries to attempt to identify what are the major components of the Act. The premise of which the Clean Air Act is based and always has been, which is to obtain acceptable air quality, which means complying with what are called ambient air quality standards for the protection of public health. And I'd like to point out there is two basic concepts when you talk about air quality standards that's very important to get clear. One is ambient standards, which are standards to set to protect what you breathe as you walk down the sidewalk, no matter what type of activities are going on in the city. And there are what are called emission standards, and they're quite different. Emission standards are limits upon the amount of pollution that can come out of a given stack, or in some cases, an open industrial yard or something of that nature. But you have emission standards that deal with the activity that generates air pollution, with the objective of, by time that the emissions from that source get blown downwind to where people live and work and play, it will comply with the ambient standards set for protecting public health. So the focus of the Act is principally to protect public health and other air resource criteria. And the Act is focused on obtaining that objective. It has a number of mechanisms to do it, one of which is the permit program, which is the concept of licensing emissions from large sources of air pollution so that the summation of those emissions do not violate public health standards. And this revision of the Clean Air Act, which is the first major change in the Act in 20 years, for the first time, Congress has said we want a relatively uniform permit program across the nation and place that burden on the steps of every state to accomplish. The permit program that we would do in the future is different than the one we've done for the last 18 to 20 years, in that what we do now does not in all cases incorporate all federal requirements into the state permit. So people that have permits now may have to deal with EPA on some provisions of federal law that aren't embodied in the permit program. We see that changing in the permit program should be an all-encompassing approach. Congress realized by doing this change in the Act that they were going to now regulate many smaller industries, businesses, and commercial enterprises through this permit program than they ever have before. Because of that, and because of the burdens of small businesses, they mandated that each state establish what is called a small business assistance program. And it is to help the small businesses understand the requirements of the Act and prepare applications and basically comply with the Act. So it's an assistance program for the small entities that are affected by the Act. Another major change in the Act is what is called the acid rain provisions, reductions that are to be accomplished from large power plants or other sources of sulfur oxides and nitrogen oxides. And it's focusing on predominantly an East Coast problem of acid rain in the Northeast Mountains, as well as it exists to some degree in the western states, in the western mountains. It does not exist in Alaska and in other locations, and in fact, Alaska is specifically exempt from this provision of the Act. And it's quite a substantial bureaucratic process involved in there, so it is fortunate from a bureaucracy point of view that we are exempt, because there really is no acid rain problem in Alaska, nor do we contribute to the problem in the East Coast or elsewhere in the U.S. Congress also established what is called 189 hazardous air pollutants. These are chemical compounds that have not been regulated on a federal level before to address concerns that have been upwelling over the last 15 years or so. Several states have embarked upon programs in the last decade to control emissions of hazardous air pollutants, but there's been no uniformity and no consensus, and it's been a generally difficult beast to tackle. So Congress now said we are going to establish 189 compounds, most of which are organic solvents, and we're going to approach controlling these emissions by implementing technology to the larger sources of those emissions over the next decade. So it's a phase-in to use technology. It does not, basically for the moment, the Clean Air Act sidelines the idea of setting what are called ambient standards for these hazardous air pollutants, because that has been a quite contentious area in the past, and a lot of times it deals upon medical research that isn't clear, and people and scientists will argue it ad nauseum over whether there's any substantive data there or not. So Congress has said, let's put that aside for a decade, let's implement technology to reduce emissions of hazardous air pollutants from the major sources that cause hazardous air pollution. Another major feature of the Act is, of course, controlling pollution from automobiles, what are called mobile sources. We in Alaska have a pollution problem from automobiles, as all of you probably know, principally in Anchorage and Fairbanks, where we exceed the public health standard for carbon monoxide in the winter months. The Clean Air Act basically places a push to make a larger effort to clean up those problems. However, this bill does not address that. There is a section in this bill that is a carryover of existing statute, as is, which is the authority to implement the automobile program we currently have underway. We do not need any new authorities to implement those cleanup efforts for carbon monoxide. So those are the major features of the Act. To get down to a little bit of the details, if you want to flip to page 2 on this handout, it gives you a little overview as to who needs a permit. Currently, we issue permits to about 170 different installations around the state. We did a survey this last summer where we sent questionnaires to some 8,000 businesses, commercial enterprises, and industries around the state. And through that, we learned that we will probably have to issue permits to about 450 installations in the future to fulfill the Clean Air Act requirements. This page gives an idea of the major breakdowns of who needs permits. The principal criteria are how much pollution do you emit? So Congress has said if you emit 100 tons per year or more of a criteria air pollutant, such as carbon monoxide or sulfur dioxide, lead, nitrogen oxides, then you are a major source of air pollution and you need to obtain a permit under this permit program. The second criteria is if you emit 10 tons per more of any single hazardous air pollutant or 25 tons of any aggregate of any one or more of the 189, then you are essentially a major source of hazardous air pollutants and you need a permit. The third category is if you are subject to any other specific federal regulations. Those federal regulations fall into two camps. One is standards set for new equipment, what are called new source performance standards. So a boiler installed in 1993 has to meet a tighter performance standard than one that was built in 1973. The other part of it is implementing the hazardous pollution, hazardous emissions technology. Those are the three basic criteria that get you into the permit program, or if you fall below the criteria, keep you out of the permit program. The next overview gives a few examples of those types of equipment around Alaska. The major reason we are shifting from 170 to 450 installations is because we have equipment, mostly fuel-burning equipment around the state, that's been in existence for a number of years, does not require a state permit currently, but emits more than 100 tons of air pollution. Right now, a general cutoff is if you emit more than 250 tons of air pollution and you're a new facility, you have to go through the state permit to accomplish certain federal review requirements. So by and large, the difference is due to fuel-burning equipment, of which that currently exists, and a large number of that is power generating equipment or other industrial processing equipment. I'd like to ask you to flip to the next chart. It gives you an illustration of what different groups of different activities in the state will need permits. This is a bar chart showing what we project as the number of permits from each different type of activity around the state. We are going to be involved in regulating a few of the small industries, such as a few of the larger dry cleaners around the state. I think the number is about 3 to 6. Some of the sand and gravel operations that do rock crushing, some of the airports that have standby power generators, some of the gasoline distribution facilities. But the, by and large, the largest number of increase is in the electric utilities, where we're, the bar chart shows we currently issue permits to 20 or 30-some facilities, and that is may go up to 140-some facilities. These are the rural power people and the small community power people, as well as oil and gas production and mining and seafood processing. Those all will have significant increases in the number of facilities that need permits, principally getting to the smaller installations that exist now that currently don't have permits. So that's an overview, and I'm sure you might have more questions about the particulars of who gets affected. But that's an idea as to who will need permits in the future. I'd like to focus a little bit on some of the basic concepts embodied in the development of this bill and the restructuring of the permit program. First of all, I want to reinforce that the department and I believe the regulated communities and most affected parties believe that it's very important to retain state jurisdiction. That's based on the concept that the state can be more responsive than the federal government can be in implementing this permit program. We're more attuned with what is needed in our Alaska communities, as well as we are closer at hand, and there is more flexibility provided in federal law to the state than if the federal government was to implement this. We also want to prevent federal intervention so that the affected parties know that they only need to come to the state about a question, that the state is essentially the one-stop shop, that if they have a question about an air permit or a federal law regarding air pollution, the state can answer the question and deal with it. They don't have to worry about, well, does the state have delegation on this, or are the feds doing this, and have uncertainty as to who to respond to or who to ask the question to. So the idea that the air permit program should be revised to incorporate all federal requirements and not just what might be viewed now as approximately 90% of the federal requirements of the current permit program, so that we have a single permit that embodies all the requirements, so that when a regulated party gets his permit, he knows that if he abides by the terms of that permit, he is complying with all 500 and some odd pages of the Clean Air Act that apply to him. This bill is also designed with many checks and balances to try and to accomplish the public health protection requirements, but also to do so in a manner that demands responsibility and accountability of the department from both a scientific point of view in evaluating whether certain actions are justified based on public health protection, as well as from a fiscal responsibility point of view. The fee structure that's embodied in this bill, and I should back up for a moment because the Clean Air Act requires that the permit program be funded entirely by the fees collected from permit holders. So it's totally self-supporting. And so the regulated community, those who have permits, must pay a fee, and the sum of all those fees must be adequate to fund the review and issuance of permits. So there, in the fee structure that's in this bill, it has several features to foster accountability both from the government end and from the industry. That costs can be lower if people understand the regulations and put together a good permit application, as well as costs are lower if compliance is readily achieved. So there's several checks and balances in the fee structure. It provides for public participation that is timely but also time certain. The Clean Air Act requires enhanced participation from what we're doing right now in the permit program, but we want to have a set window of time so that once the participation is accomplished and decisions are made, that the regulated party has certainty in the decisions that was made. There's also provision for general permits in here to try to streamline some of these requirements, especially for the small facilities, so that we can reduce the bureaucracy and the review and the cost of this, where the activity is uniform or similar to other facilities and it can be handled quickly. The final item on this page, certainly not the least important, is that the permit program needs to be based upon knowledge and understanding of the requirements. That we need to have a program both in statute and regulation that is explicit so that all parties know what the rules are and know when the rules are either complied with or broken and what the consequences of that is. That's not the case in the current permit program. Our current regulations are inadequate as far as people knowing exactly what they need to do, how to get a permit, and how to comply with the law. It's too open to interpretation. So that is one of the things we need to correct, and we intend to correct with this revised permit program. Mr. Chairman and committee members, that's the major features of the overview I wanted to accomplish. I would certainly be willing to answer any questions.
Okay, I think we'll take one or two questions, then we're going to go to the teleconference. Chairman McGrain?
Yes, I have several questions. One, could you explain how the bill goes beyond the federal requirements? Which sections of the bill?
There is, Representative McLean, there is a couple areas of the bill that go beyond federal requirements, one of which is the ability to issue permits in the Outer Continental Shelf region, offshore activities for principally oil and gas and mining. That's an activity we have the ability to receive delegation from the federal government, but it's not required to do. There is another section, there's other portions of the bill that speak to when the department may regulate a source or regulate an air pollutant that is not regulated in federal law. And that's principally embodied in sections 010 and 015 of the bill, which are right at the beginning of the bill, that speak to the types of evaluations the department must do and the types of review that must be accomplished outside of the department if there is perceived to be a need to regulate beyond the federal law. That's entwined in a few other areas of the bill, especially when it talks about what local governments can do. Local governments, the way this is crafted, local governments can also go beyond what is federal law or what is state law if they follow the same similar procedures of evaluating the situation, using the best scientific data that can be compiled and subjecting that to outside department review, and then taking that to public scrutiny before a decision is ever taken that action.
Within the federal law, there are some areas that are optional. Now, what areas within this bill are optional?
Well, one area would be general permits. General permits is clearly an option that the state can exercise. It's not a mandated feature. But yet, everybody, I believe, or I don't speak for everybody, many people believe that it is a very important element of this. Another area in the bill is where it talks about authority of the department in cases of emergency, where if there is a natural emergency that would exist or cause, such as a large earthquake or volcanic incident, where you might lose electrical power or other infrastructure requirements, you could the commissioner or delegatees could authorize operations of sources or expand the operation of a licensed source to attempt to handle the situation.
Within the federal law, there were some areas that were also optional in the penalty section. Now, what areas are optional within the penalty section?
The bill, as it's crafted now, pretty much achieves only the minimum requirements as far as what is required in both civil and criminal sanctions that might be imposed for violations.
Okay. At this time, I'd like to move on and take more of the public testimony, and Mr. Chappell will be available to answer any questions in the future also. So if we could move to Valdez, please, and we have Leanne Ferry, the first person to testify before the committee. Leanne, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, the committee is ready for your testimony.
My name is Leanne Ferry, and I'm a member of the Valdez staff of the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. I'm speaking today on behalf of the RCAC, and in particular on behalf of the RCAC Terminal Operations and Environmental Monitoring Committee. The TOM Committee is responsible for monitoring chronic pollution emitted from the Alyeska Marine Terminal and the environmental effects of this pollution. As you probably know, the Alyeska Terminal emits more volatile organic compounds into the air than any other facility in North America. On the average, 250,000 pounds of VOCs are released from the terminal every day of the year. Most of it as tankers are loaded with crude oil from the Trans-Alaska pipeline. These emissions include air toxics like benzene and hexane. It was unclear to us whether this bill would allow DEC to regulate air toxics and VOC emissions from tank vessels, such as the oil tankers that call at the Valdez terminal. It was unclear whether emissions from vessels could be attributed to the Alyeska facility and regulated under this bill. We were concerned about this, so we wrote DEC and asked the department to tell us whether this bill would allow the department to regulate tanker vessel emissions. The department wrote us back, but they didn't answer our question, so we are still worried. And if your committee can answer this question, it would be very helpful. We have other concerns as well. As you probably know, the bill would preclude the state from enacting air pollution rules more strict than the minimum required under the Federal Clean Air Act, unless the state meets an unusually high standard for scientifically demonstrating a need for the rules. We can tell you from our own experience here in Valdez, where we have participated in the assessment of health risks from benzene emitted at the Alyeska Marine Terminal, that the process of scientifically demonstrating a health risk can be a protracted and messy one, and it can take a very long time. It is difficult to conclusively demonstrate a health or environmental hazard, and it is very easy to cast doubt on such a demonstration. That is why technology-based standards are the norm in many other states, and that is why much of the Federal Clean Air Act amendments are devoted to technology-based emission standards. Technology-based standards require polluters to control emissions over certain threshold amounts if such controls are feasible and economically reasonable. But this bill would tie DEC's hands in adopting any such standards if they were stricter than federal standards. The EPA itself advised the DEC to move ahead quickly with rules to restrict these emissions back when DEC drafted such rules in 1990. Those rules have been shelved, and with this legislation, they'd be moved from the shelf to the dumpster. We understand the Alaska Air Quality Advisory Committee to have been a forum in which industry regulators and the public could work together to come up with a consensus for state clean air legislation. This group worked long and hard to come up with compromises necessary to achieve such a consensus. But now it appears that since the advisory committee completed its work, the clean air bill has been changed to such an extent that it does not represent the wishes of the group or the public. We believe it now represents the interests of one industry that chose not to participate in the committee process. This is not the oil industry, by the way, which did have representatives on the advisory committee. The RCAC is a citizens group dedicated to public participation in environmental protection, so we are quite disappointed that the work of this advisory committee has been set aside. We agree with the members of the advisory committee who have said they would rather have no bill rather than this bill. In light of the legislature's current action to slash DEC's budget, it's questionable whether the department would have the funding or staff to administer new clean air regulations in any case. Thank you.
Thank you, Leanne. If we could move to Nancy Lethko, I believe the pronunciation is. We heard from Nancy the other day.
Thank you, Representative Larson, and the Plan Committee members for the opportunity to speak before you today. For the record, my name is Nancy Lethko. I am the President of the Alaska Wilderness Recreation and Tourism Association. When the Alaska Wilderness Guides Association reorganized last year as the Alaska Wilderness Recreation and Tourism Association, we did so in recognition of the numerous threats to our businesses. I asked members to identify the major threats to the success of their businesses. To my surprise, air pollution has consistently been mentioned. Tour and lodge operators at Denali National Park and Fairbanks are concerned about the proposed heat and power plant. Any activities that would reduce visitors to Denali would have an adverse economic impact on tourism to Fairbanks. Other tour operators, lodge owners, outfitters, and guides include threats to the Kenai National Moose Range, Glacier Bay National Park, Wrangell-St. Elias National Park, Fort Valdez, and Nisqually area. People engaged in outdoor activities breathe more toxins and have a greater health risk. They are much more sensitive to air pollution. In August 1992, we contacted DEC and asked to have a seat on the Air Quality Advisory Committee. Our request was refused in September on the grounds that because the new aspects of this law relate to air permit reform, the decision was made at the outset to limit participation to those entities required to have permits under the Act. This policy failed to recognize that one point of regulations is to manage our resources so that one sector of the business community does not affect public health or other sectors of the business community. The total business climate would be enhanced by regulations which provide for maximum use of our resources and create more jobs. After several more letters and phone calls, we were finally put on their mailing list, but in effect, our segment of business community has not been a party to the discussion. We have five major concerns. The first is that we regard this as a big business bill because it makes it difficult and virtually impossible for small, non-polluting businesses to participate in the public process. For example, last January, DEC published a notice on revisions to the Alaska's air quality permit. The notice was so vague that businesses affected by the modifications, ARTA and RCAC, all missed the importance of this notice. Later, we discovered that major modifications in Alaska's permit were proposed. Under section 0.285 on page 20 of your bill, public participation is made even more difficult. We request that the word may at line 19 be changed to shall. Two, section 200 on page 12 makes it difficult for us to appeal decisions. The words private and substantive have not been defined in environmental law. They are not used in state laws concerning standing. With two operates at Denali National Park have standing, ARTA have standing. It is clear that they would probably face not only the cost of appeal, but also the cost of finding out how these terms are going to be defined. And if we lose our case, we would under legislation working its way through the legislature now also bear the cost of the winning party. We request that this section be changed to guarantee that other businesses and business organizations which could be adversely affected by a permit be allowed to appeal. We will also have, I have two other points that I would like to make. This bill is a big business bill that hurts smaller businesses in the way it excesses fees. Currently, indirect costs are borne by all polluters through the permit fees rather than by those who pollute the most. We recommend the following changes. On page 3, section 15, we suggest either deleting the section or covering the cost through emission fees. At the moment, it is unclear to us whether the cost would be covered by the general fund or permit fees. We also suggest that section 0.240 on page 15, item 1, be amended to shift the cost to the emission fees. In this way, those who pollute the most would pay the most. It also encourages companies to reduce their pollution, which would reduce the cost of their business neighbors. For small businesses in local communities have the best chance of protecting their clients, public health, and the natural resources on which they depend through local ordinances. However, the fee structure established on page 24 under D places an undue financial burden on local communities. Studies envisioned in section 10 could cost millions of dollars. Local communities have to wait perhaps a year or more to recover these costs from the state. They should be allowed to bill the polluter directly. Without the power to bill polluters directly and recover their costs in a more timely manner, local governments and local business communities are effectively deprived of their right to set regulations. Finally, in section 10, on page 2, on line 26, after the word demonstrate, we would like to see the word in writing added. Thank you very much, and I really wish you would give us 5 minutes to testify in the future.
Go ahead and take a couple of extra minutes if you'd like, Nancy.
Well, I'm hoping that this came across. I read it as fast as I could, and Leanne read hers as fast as we could, but I've covered, I think, most of the points and skipped some elaboration on why our thinking went along these lines.
Yeah. Well,
but I don't know whether you could even catch what we said listening.
Mr. Chairman?
Sure. You could... of course, fax us your complete testimony, and our fax number would be 465-2278, and I would see that everyone gets a copy of your testimony in detail there. We will move to Anchorage, and then we'll come back to Valdez. If you ladies would like a couple of extra minutes, that would be fine. So let's move to Anchorage and take Eric Myers at this time.
Thank you, Representative Larson. As a member of the Air Quality Advisory Work Group that was impaneled by DEC last session, I wanted to take a moment to reflect on the process that has occurred since the end of last session. For those of you who were around last session, you probably were aware that this legislation is extremely controversial and resulted in a complete impasse at the very end of the session. As a result of that difficulty last session, DEC tried to establish a working group that could come to a consensus among affected parties, the oil and gas industry, utilities, the fishing industry, the military, and others, including a representative of the general public, myself, and a representative of the environment. environmental community. That group worked long and hard to try and come to a genuine consensus position and produce legislation for recommendation to the legislature, which was introduced on the Senate side by the Senate Resources Committee and on the House side by Representative Brown. It was a long, difficult process that involved a lot of genuine compromise and hard work by the members of that Air Quality Advisory Work Group. And surprisingly, I think in the eyes of many, we did come together with a unanimous recommendation in support of legislation. Since that bill has been introduced, however, the work of the committee has been subverted by one disaffected industry not represented on that committee by its own choice. And it's in this context that I have come to feel that the legislation that's currently before you is not supportable. Specifically, I refer to the timber industry, which was solicited to participate in the working group process, and it declined deliberately and chose instead to bring its complaints and concerns and positions directly to the legislature and avoid the process. There were many people that advised me not to participate in the advisory work group because of the view or the concern that process would co-opt the opportunity that I might have or that others might have to express their views to the legislature. But in good faith, I chose to participate and have been extremely disappointed that the legislature, in part anyway, has sought to set aside the hard work and consensus view of the work group and make amendments. Now, there are many, many portions of this bill that I personally don't favor, but many of those I have agreed to previously. But there are some changes, and at least one in particular that I want to highlight that was made since the work group put forward its work that I feel has fatally flawed this legislation. Specifically, I refer to Section 010, which was last year, and I believe this year, the most controversial portion of the legislation. The central issue concerns what regulatory authority the state will reserve to itself or that the legislature will provide to the Department of Environmental Conservation to regulate air pollutants in a manner that may be more stringent than the federal government or in advance of the federal government if there is no regulatory standard or that would obtain in the case of a particular air pollutant. The way the bill presently reads, Section 010, and specifically on page 2, the legislation codifies a standard which essentially places profitability above public health, and that's very clearly stated in Section 010C2, which requires that before a regulation may be adopted that would either regulate in advance of the federal government or in a manner more stringent than the federal government, that it be demonstrated that the proposed regulation be technologically and economically feasible. Now, while it's appropriate that economic considerations and technological feasibility be given due consideration, and that's something that the working group endorsed all the way along, to establish as an absolute requirement that profitability be demonstrated prior to there being a regulation adopted, would preclude, even in severe cases, chronic health hazards from being regulated by the federal, by the state agency. An example of a case in point that is illustrative would be the case. There's only been two cases in which the state has chosen to exercise its regulatory authority in a manner that exceeds or regulates a substance the federal government hasn't regulated, and those two cases are the Government Hill Tank Farms and the Nikiski Refinery. In the case of the Government Hill Tank Farm, if some regulation had been proposed that would have required internal floating tank lids, and some particular portion of the tank farm community felt that it was not economically feasible, that regulatory initiative would have been frustrated. This is a terrible some public interest members has not supported this proposed change and, in fact, worked out alternative language for 010 and offered that for consideration. The other particular point I wanted to emphasize or draw attention to also concerned the treatment of volatile organic compound regulations, regulation of volatile organic compounds at the Valdez terminal. I don't think that that has been addressed clearly in my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Okay, at this time, I'd like to move back to Valdez, see if there's any additional comments, and then hear from Russell Heath here in the audience. So, any additional comments from Valdez?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. We are trying to rewrite our some of our notes and put them together here for you and fax them to you. I want to say how much I appreciate your coming back to us and how much how sensitive you have been to our frustration at trying to give you testimony in such a rapid-fire fashion. We're very appreciative of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Could we move to Russell, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Russell Heath. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Environmental Lobby. The Environmental Lobby is a coalition of 20 Alaskan environmental groups. Last year, Alaska's environmental community was asked to join a working committee put together by DEC in an effort to develop legislation which would bring Alaska into conformity with the 1990 amendments to the Federal Clean Air Act. We were offered one seat on a committee represented almost exclusively by industry interests. We were told that committee decisions would be carried by a two-thirds vote, a process which meant that the concerns of the environmental representative would frequently be buried beneath those of the industry-dominated majority. Despite these shortcomings, the environmental community participated in good faith on the working committee to help develop a bill that was both sensitive to industry needs as well as to those of Alaskans who value our clean air. The bill that was crafted by the working committee is not the bill the environmental community would have written if we'd be given a free hand to draft it ourselves. Nevertheless, we supported it and worked to move it through the legislature. Soon after the working committee's bill was introduced into the legislature, a second competing bill, HB 167, was also introduced. Both bills were referred to our Senate Resources Subcommittee in order to produce a single bill. Sitting at the same table with the senators was a representative of the timber industry. Why was this one industry that refused to work with the other industries and members of the public to protect the diverse needs of all Alaskans invited to give its input now? The product of that Senate subcommittee was incorporated into HB 167, the bill before this committee today. The Alaska Environmental Lobby opposes HB 167. We oppose it for a number of reasons. But I want to mention just a few which illustrate how this legislation fails to protect the quality of Alaska's air, how it restricts the public's right to influence public policy, and how it restricts the rights of local governments to control the quality of the air in their own communities and neighborhoods. I would like to note that several of the provisions in this bill, which we oppose, were originally developed by DEC's working committee. Like many of the other members of the committee, we made compromises we weren't fully comfortable with. But since then, the bill has been modified so greatly that we can no longer live with many of these compromises. The fee structure which exists in HB 167 was developed by DEC's working committee. It subverts the key intent of the Clean Air Act, which is to reduce emissions. Logically, the size of the fee should be tied directly to the amount emitted, providing a powerful incentive for the polluter to reduce its emissions. Yet the fee structure in HB 167 ties the bulk of the fees not to the amount emitted, but to the per-hour cost to DEC to process the permit application. The incentive to the polluter then becomes to submit a letter perfect permit application. Because the faster DEC can process the application, the cheaper it becomes for the polluter. Fundamentally, this fee structure disembowels the entire act, rendering it an expensive exercise in paper shuffling. But let's look a little closer at the fee structure. The permit program is supposed to be self-funding. The total cost of the program did not change when the fee structure did. So if the big emitters are paying less, who is paying more? Well, it's the small emitters. Note that the small business was not represented on the committee. However, transferring so large a burden onto small businesses was not entirely acceptable. So another arrangement, the general permit, was developed to reduce a portion of the burden. A general permit is a blanket permit which applies to all emitters of a similar type. An individual emitter need not go through the entire expensive permitting process. At the time that a general permit is developed, public review is solicited statewide. But the public is not allowed to comment when a specific business in a specific neighborhood is granted a general permit. So who other than small business ultimately lost when the fee structure was altered to favor the big polluters? The neighborhood in which a general permit holder is cited, since general permits do not allow for the consideration of the special needs of communities that may have particular air quality problems, such as other air polluters in the vicinity. Again, this is a common theme running throughout this entire legislation, the sometimes subtle and sometimes blatant narrowing of the public's right to influence the procedures by which the quality of the air for a particular neighborhood or municipality is determined. A few more examples. Judicial standing is narrowed beyond current Alaskan statute in HB 167. Standing is the legal criteria which an aggrieved party must satisfy prior to being legally eligible to maintain or obtain judicial review of a permit. Standing was narrowed in order to protect the polluting industry from lawsuits challenging their permits. Once again, this legislation is closing the public process to the citizen. For example, under this legislation, you have standing if you participated in the public comment process prior to the issuance of a permit. However, if the business is just setting up shop in your neighborhood is granted a general permit, your opportunity to comment was when the general permit was first developed, which may have been 2, 3, or more years previously, long before there was any hint of the possibility of an air polluter coming to your town. Should we be writing law to protect industry by circumscribing the rights of concerned citizens? It is important to remember that it is the industries regulated by this act who have written this language restricting the public's rights. In other words, it is the parties threatened by judicial challenges who are determining the eligibility of those who may challenge them. This is a conflict of interest. In the DEC Working Committee's bill, the duration of the air quality permits could vary. In HB 167, the duration is fixed at 5 years. This is a substantial departure from current administration policy. Today, if a business is an historical violator, its permit is written for a shorter period of time so that the public has a chance to comment more frequently on its impact on the safety of the community. A shorter permit period also provides the state the chance to incorporate the best permit stipulations possible to assist a business in coming into compliance with its permit. DEC's working committee arrived at a satisfactory compromise which allows all businesses without compliance problems to receive the maximum permit term of 5 years. Repeat and gross violators who cannot follow our state laws are given permits with a shorter duration. As soon as a violating business achieves compliance, it is given the same privilege of a 5-year permit as complying businesses have. Varying the permit's duration provides an excellent incentive for compliance, provides privileges to our industries who care about being a positive part of Alaska's communities and economy for the long term. The oil industry felt this arrangement met their needs, as did the seafood processors, as well as did most of the other members on the DEC Working Committee. Why was it removed from HB 167? Perhaps because a fixed 5-year permit provides less incentive to comply and less opportunity for public and municipal review. There are provisions in this legislation which would make it effectively impossible for state and local governments to require standards more stringent than those required by the Federal Clean Air Act. This section, which requires peer review of studies demonstrating that local conditions vary from those in which the federal standards are based, are so complex and so expensive that it would render a municipality powerless, or virtually powerless, to address local needs and concerns. The state of Alaska currently has this authority, free from these requirements, and standards more stringent than the federal government requires now exist in Anchorage and Nikiski. State and local governments must have the authority to address our community's concerns. Alaskans have fought for years to emancipate themselves from federal bureaucrats. Why deliver ourselves to them now? I would like to step back just for a moment and put this into a broader context. Several legislators have spoken to me in the past few months since I've been here about the need to create some mechanism whereby environmentalists and others can resolve their disputes outside of the courtroom. Though flawed, the DEC Advisory Committee was an example of just such a forum. And here before you, you have one of the reasons why so many times environmentalists, neighborhood organizations, civil rights groups, women's groups, and a host of other public interest groups end up in court. We get cut out of the process. We got cut out of the process when the timber industry joined the Senate subcommittee. We, and that is all Alaskans, are getting cut out of the process when legislation such as this is enacted, which weakens public control over the quality of life in our own neighborhoods. 2, 4, or more years from now, this legislation will spawn a rat's nest litigation. No one here should be surprised. Thank you.
Thank you, Russell. Did we have anyone else in the audience who wanted to be heard today?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Brown?
I would request that we ask to hear from the Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Torok is here. And the EPA opinion on this is certainly of interest and concern.
Welcome to House Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stephen Torok. I am Chief of the State Operations Section for EPA Region 10 here in Juneau. EPA Region 10 has not yet prepared final comments on this version of House Bill 167. However, I did have the opportunity to speak with our office in Seattle this morning. There are a couple areas that does raise concern to us that we have had initial discussions with DEC, and we'll have to have further discussions in order to resolve at least our questions. Primarily, sections 46, 14, 560, unavoidable malfunctions and emergencies. This is a new section that raises some concerns to EPA. Primarily, the way it reads, at least the way we read it, is that the way it is written, it constitutes or gives affirmative defense to permittees. It does not require the permittee to demonstrate affirmative defense. It gives them affirmative defense. And under the Clean Air Act, there are no provisions for unilateral across-the-board affirmative defense. What it does indicate also is an underlying enforcement problem or a potential problem if it remains as it is. It would probably or possibly render the state's state implementation plan not acceptable or the Title V program unacceptable, at least the way we read it right now. We will have to have further deliberations on it, though, from a legal perspective. The other area of concern that EPA has expressed both to the House Finance Committee and also the Senate Finance Committee was the overall budget that is being proposed for DEC and the budget reductions. Primary concern of the reductions proposed by the Senate version of the bill, and that specifically is the elimination of the $700,000 of program receipts. And we do or are aware of the Senate intent language allowing DEC to go back to legislative budget and audit. But what it does do, or what DEC will have to do in order to have their program approved by EPA, is demonstrate that it has the fiscal capability and willingness to properly fund the program. And so that measure in the Senate version of the DEC bill does raise some questions to EPA. However, on the positive note, we'd like to commend DEC, the committee, and all those parties that have participated in the development of the legislation. We feel that the process is on the right track, that with possibly some minor modifications or clarifications, we feel that the bill generally meets the minimum requirements that will be required by EPA. And with that, I'll cease and be able to respond to questions if there are any.
Thank you. At this time, I have to excuse myself for a couple of minutes, so if I could turn the gavel over to Chairman McLean, please.
Okay.
But before I leave, I do want to thank the people who testified in Valdez and here in Juneau and also in Anchorage today. And thank you, too, very much, sir. Excuse me 1 minute.
I did have a question. One, what was the first section that you had a concern with, and what page of the bill?
Madam Chair, Mr. Finney, it's
page 30.
Page 30, I believe. In section 4614, 560, unavoidable malfunctions and emergencies.
Okay, thank you. Representative Braun?
Thank you. When do you expect that EPA Region 10's final comments would be available on this version?
Madam Chair, Representative Brown, I'm hoping that we will be able to have written comments by tomorrow.
Could I ask another question?
Representative Brown, go ahead, continue.
Thank you. Do you have a copy of the bill there? Could you look to page 3, subsection E, beginning at line 6? I've been trying to understand the implications of requiring that anything that is going to be in a permit shall be adopted in regulation. And as I read this, it seems like it's saying that anything that could be generally applicable to an individual source or facility type shall be in regulation, or otherwise it could not be incorporated into a permit. And I'm wondering, with the phase in of this program and the startup time, and recognizing the very long timeline on adoption of regulations, how this would work in practice. And I just wondered if you have given any thought to how the program would actually be implemented and the requirement that all conditions of the permit essentially be adopted in regulation before they could be put into a permit.
Madam Chair, Representative Brown, I'm not aware that in specific reference to that section that EPA has raised any particular concerns with that. We, of course, In our review of the state's program, DEC will have to submit to EPA not only the authorizing legislation and the regulation package, but also their procedures and the implementation plan for how they intend to implement the permitting program. Right off hand, and I will check with our SAIL office to see if this particular issue is a concern, right off the cuff, I don't really see that we would have a problem with the requirement that any provisions of the permit be required in regulation. If, for example, if through the course of operating the permit of the program, other areas are found or other issues are resolved or come to light that would cause a revision of the permit, the state would have the authority to revise a permit, or when that permit is due for revision, to incorporate any of the further provisions. So those adjustments can be made at that time.
So is it your expectation that when DEC submits the program for approval, it will have adopted all regulations that would be influencing individual permit conditions? That's how I read this. That the department would be precluded from including a particular permit condition that could be arguably generally applicable unless the unless you had actually gone through the process of adopting a regulation. And I just don't see, I mean, I can see that initially we would have a lot of regulations to adopt just to get the basic parts fleshed out that are not specifically set up in the statute. But then when you get into permitting, the actual permitting for individual facilities, any condition that the department might want to put there that could also maybe apply to somebody else, the permittee would argue you can't impose that because it's not in regulation. So will the upfront regulatory process have to anticipate all permits and all conditions and all sources and all facility types in order to have a workable program and permits that mean anything?
Madam Chair, Representative Brown, I will have to consult with our regional office and see how we're on that.
Thank you.
Representative Hanley and then Representative Martin.
Thank you. I didn't actually have any questions. I just want to point out for the committee that most of the issues that have been raised will be discussed, I think, and for the people that are in teleconference, I believe Representative Brown has a number of amendments that will get to specific discussion of most of the issues, I think, that have been raised by the numerous people that have testified. So.
Representative Martin.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm glad you gave a little positive note on this bill for all the effort that has been done. And sometimes I'm concerned with some groups are saying that we will never get a perfect thing, we will never get a perfect bill, and we haven't had time, we haven't had months or years to work on it. At this moment, in your position, would you give this vehicle a green light to progress, to move ahead? Otherwise, we'll have another standoff like we did last year. I think we need a vehicle to work on, and then as normalcy has it in a democratic society, we can improve it each session, each year. Is things so bad that we shouldn't pass nothing?
Madam Chair, Representative Martin, as I indicated, we are in the process of preparing formal comments on this version of the bill. And as far as I know, the only major area that we have concerns and questions on is that I referenced. I would offer that the bill is a basis. Our comments up to this point indicate that the bill does meet generally minimum requirements that would be required by the federal government. I think as testimony has been given by other parties that everybody may have written the bill differently if they were so doing, but often pieces of legislation like this is in fact a compromise. I will not be able to offer any other comments until I actually see the comments from Seattle, and especially with regards to that one section.
Yeah. Well, concern is that we have less than 1 month, and I think a lot of people have given good faith with it, and hopefully you all would have give us your blessing for the work that's been done by those who have worked so hard. We got the Senate next to get through, so it's my concern that something be done this year with your group's blessing that will improve it as life allows us to.
Madam Chair, Representative Martin, what we do not have the flexibility to do is approving a state program with legislation that does not meet the minimum provisions of federal law. We will not be able to do that.
And so, but as it is now, you see that we'll meet most of the provisions. Yep.
Representative Martin, yes, I do, except for those provisions that we've indicated that we do have some questions and concerns on.
Okay. Thank
you. Representative Brown.
Thank you. In one of the early written comments from EPA, you objected to Section 540 on page 29. I understand you've now modified that position, and I don't have anything in writing indicating that you've modified that position. What was your concern with 540, and what is your position on it at this time?
Madam Chair, Representative Brown, our concern at the time was that as it was written, that section The federal law does not recognize or take into account the possibility of a natural disaster. What it does do, what Congress did anticipate EPA to do, in that in such cases, that the agency would have enforcement discretion. So in the case of a natural disaster where a piece of equipment that would have to be brought in to operate, for example, a power plant for emergency power that was not permitted, would be allowed to operate, and the agency would choose carry out its enforcement discretion in not imposing fines or penalties. So that's how Congress intended emergencies of that sort to be handled. The provisions that are in the state legislation gives authority to the commissioner to waive permitting requirements in cases of disasters. And as such, we would not be able to approve that. However, what we have indicated to the department is that the department could submit its program for EPA approval minus that provision. And EPA would be watching the state in its implementation of the program to see if, in any cases, that authority given to the department was in fact being abused. And if that were to occur, then EPA would be in a position to impose its enforcement discretion. And that's how we intended to deal with that.
Go ahead and continue. In your memo of February 18, you also questioned the part about standing, and I believe that is on page 12 of the bill at this point. Review of permit action, beginning at page 12, line 22, you said this provision would unacceptably narrow the standing for judicial review. The Federal Clean Air Act and EPA regulations require that the opportunity to obtain judicial review be available to the applicant, any person who participated in the process, and any other person who could obtain judicial review of that action under applicable law. EPA interprets this to mean any restrictions on the applicant and any person who participated may not exceed the limits on judicial review imposed by standing of the U.S. Constitution. And you suggested that some language here be deleted in order to address that. Is that still a concern? Has that concern been resolved in some way? Or what is your current thinking on that section?
Madam Chair, Representative Brown, I do not know the status of EPA's position on that, and I might ask Senator Roberts, we had discussions with Seattle.
No, we won't.
If I may, Madam Chair, Representative Brown, if there was discussions, have been discussions that may have clarified that.
Madam Chair, Representative Brown, my name is Robert Regis. I'm with the Department of Law. We deleted a phrase from that section that had been specifically referenced by the EPA, and we believe that that resolved their concern.
Representative Brown.
And Madam Chair, Representative Brown, we will be addressing that or confirming that in our comments, in our written comments.
Yeah, I am distributing now an opinion from Terry Lauterbach, our legal counsel for the legislature, who says that she believes that the bill as it now stands does not comply with federal law, and discusses that. And I would like to have Mr. Regis on record discussing his opinion on it and raise this issue. I don't know if this is a good time, if you want to get into that issue at this time, or while we have all these people here that could shed light on the issue.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Regis?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Brown.
You need to turn your mic on.
I'm a little uncomfortable engaging in a continuing point-counterpoint with my peers in legislative the legislative lawyers on this issue. It is certainly not what we're talking about here. Are two words on page 12, line 24. Those words are private and substantive. And the question that originally arose was whether this narrows the accessibility to the courts that presently exists. There's been some discussion back and forth. I don't see any benefit to anyone for me to continue to engage in point-counterpoint with Ms. Lauterbach. So let's start with a concession on my part that it does, in fact, narrow standing as that has been developed in the state of Alaska. The next question becomes, well, there are two questions then. One, as a policy matter, is that a good idea? And I voice no opinion on that. That's not my job. And two, whether if it does narrow, or assuming that it does narrow standing as currently exists, is it permissible under the Clean Air Act? I would respectfully differ from Ms. Lauterbach's conclusion that it does violate the Clean Air Act, but it's certainly not a definitive position. Specifically, the Clean Air Act simply says that we must provide access to the courts to any person who could obtain judicial review under applicable law. So the question becomes, when is applicable law reviewed? Is it the applicable law that existed in 1990 when the Clean Air Act was adopted? Is that the point in time at which we look at standing? If so, then Ms. Lauterbach is unequivocally correct. We could not then go in and narrow it now in 1993 because the Clean Air Act said we must provide judicial review under applicable law. I have taken a different position. My position is that applicable law would include this bill, and so that if you chose as a policy matter to narrow standing in this bill, that would become applicable law, and it would not violate the language in the Clean Air Act that says we must provide standing to any person who could obtain judicial review of that action under applicable law. So that's the basis of our difference, really, is must you delete those two words because of the Clean Air Act? I believe Ms. Lauterbach would say, yes, you must. I say, no, you do not have to, and it becomes a policy decision of whether you want to, in fact, narrow standing as it currently exists, which I will concede that language does do.
Representative Brown.
Okay, on a different subject, just looking at the sentence, whether we took that out or not, in order to bring an action, you would either have to be the owner or operator, you would have to participate in the process, or you would have to show that you were adversely affected by the permit action. Is that a correct reading of this? In other words, legally protected interest under state law is modified by the phrase that may be adversely affected by the permit action. Is that correct?
Madam Chairman, Representative Brown, I would say that is correct, but that is not even, that it is limited even more than that. This third category of persons, you have the one category, owner and operator. Second category, anyone who participated in the public comment process. Third category is this person who not only has a legally protected interest that may adversely be affected, but as the bill currently exists, that interest must be private and substantive and adversely affected by, as well as legally protected. So it's more, yes, you're right. That just doesn't go far enough. He had, as currently written, that other individual who did not participate in the public comment process and who is neither the owner nor the operator would have to show that his interest was private, that it was substantive, and that it was legally protected and may adversely be affected.
And a private interest being what kind of interest? Is that in opposite or standing in contrast to a public interest or somebody who might bring a suit on behalf of the general public? Or what do you mean? What's meant by these words, private and substantive?
Again, that's open to debate. I have taken the position that private is to be juxtaposed against associational interests. That's typically the way it would be used in the standing context. So, for instance, if you had an organization, that organization may be required by this language to bring the action in the name of one of its members rather than in its own name, and would have to demonstrate standing through an individual rather than through the collected associative interest.
Well, to take a practical example, would it require that you show that you live next door and therefore the air that you breathe is affected on some kind of ongoing basis or something, or just that you're a citizen of that community and might occasionally drive through that neighborhood? Or what's the level of standard someone would have to show to qualify under this language?
Madam Chair, Representative Brown, let me preface my answer by saying that standing is a concept created by courts. They never or very rarely come out and put little parameters on it. They define it in rather amorphous terms. And it does evolve. It changes over the years. It changes over the jurisdictions. So with that understanding of what we're dealing with here, which is a judicial-made concept of who has access to the courts, the basic premise is that you must have a legally redressable interest. You must receive some benefit, if you will, by the outcome of the case. The case must resolve the issue that you have a personal stake in the outcome, is the phrase that is often used by the courts, that you have a personal stake in the outcome. Now, that has at times been interpreted very, very remotely. People arguably had a personal stake in the outcome of the cleanup of Prince William Sound, even though they lived in Florida, because they cared about Prince William Sound. There have been other times where it was interpreted more narrowly to be meaning the person next door. All due respect and deference to our Supreme Court, they have typically taken the broader interpretation. Their concept of standing is usually quite broad.
Madam Chair.
Representative Brown.
Thank you. Could we go to section 010, and I would like your opinion of subsection E on page 3, line 6, and what this language will require with respect to the initial issuance of permits by the department, and how did you, I think we're here for the other exchange earlier, and whether you have any thoughts on what this means in subsection E.
Madam Chair, Representative Brown, I think the operative language is on line 6, the very first introductory clause. When incorporated into a permit, then those standards, which are generally applicable, must be adopted by regulation. The concept is that at least one permit could issue first, that you could at least issue the first permit with that standard in it. And then as you began to implement that permit, or permits, I'm not certain, as I look at the language, whether it would allow several permits to issue. And perhaps instead of saying when incorporated into a permit, you would want to say when incorporated into one or more permits. But at least a single permit could issue first with the standard. And then as the agency began to realize that it had a broader application, they would be required to adopt it in regulations before going forward and adding it into subsequent permits.
Madam Chair, can I continue?
Representative Brown.
Well, that is my understanding, what you just said, of how it was supposed to work. I'm very concerned that I don't think this language says that. What it says is, or what it seems to say, is you can't put anything into a permit unless it is in regulation if it could be generally applicable. And it seems to me that what you said is how, in fact, it will have to be implemented, because it's not going to be physically possible for the agency to, both get the initial parts of the program up and running and address every single facility and every single permit condition in a regulatory form before any permits are issued. And if you agree with that, perhaps you could help us come up with some language that more accurately describes what we're talking about happening in the process.
Madam Chair, Representative Brown, as I've stated, the use of the past tense in that introductory clause clearly anticipates that at least one permit would issue first. So when incorporated into a permit, thereafter you would have to incorporate it, into regulation. Nonetheless, I think the Department of Law would be more comfortable, in light of your remarks, Representative Brown, if it said when incorporated into one or more permits instead of a permit. That would give the department some time to, you know, not just issue one permit and then stop the whole process until it got around to putting it in regulation, that they could continue issuing permits with this generally applicable standard until such time as it was able to finalize that in regulation.
One last question, because we will have to recess until 1:30 today.
Wouldn't one permit still have the same flaw as is arguably present with this language now? How about more than one, when incorporated into more than one? Because if your intention is to allow it for one, it seems like it still doesn't quite get there. But I appreciate you thinking about this. Maybe at our next session we can refine this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Brown, and thank you, Mr. Regis. And for the moment, we will recess and come back into session this afternoon at 1:30. When incorporated into one.